be grateful for the privilege of being able to enjoy with you the blessings of this coming together. You know, there's something about a positive workshop designed to sharpen people's consciousness of a lost world that just naturally brings our people together. I don't despair of the church so long as I find that unity and love and fellowship are right at the very core of our gatherings, and that where you find the biggest crowds of our people gathered, you find the most enthusiasm, the most encouragement, the most hope, and the greater expectations. And so I rejoice at the opportunity to share with you these 2 days. And I'm going back into the Old Testament for the basis of today's lesson. I find the longer I preach, the more I keep going back to the Old Testament for sermon text. Not long ago, I heard a lady say, "I wish they hadn't bound the New Testament with the Old Testament." She said, "The Old Testament is so full of long names that are hard to pronounce and sentences that are hard to understand. And all you need to save your soul is in the New Testament anyway. And so I just wish we didn't have anything but a New Testament." And the thought occurred to me, what a tragedy that would be. Why, the New Testament nowhere argues God. When you come into the New Testament, God is taken for granted. The Jews all knew about Him. They'd had a couple of thousand years of experience with Him, and there wasn't any use to make any arguments about the existence of God. If you want to learn anything about God, you have to go to the Old Testament. And since God never changes, if you want to know what kind of God you've got now, go back and read your Old Testament. It's a kind of sobering picture of God that you get by reading the Old Testament. And really, if you want to know what God expects of His people today, the church, go back and take a look at what God expected of His people then, for Israel was the church in the wilderness. They had gotten out of bondage. They had followed Moses through the Red Sea, been baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, had eaten of the quail and manna, and had drunk from the rock. They had their ups and downs like churches do today. Their faith was small like ours is, and their doubters were many like ours are. And the folks who said it can never be done, we can't take the land, outnumbers those who said we could by 6-1. So they had just about the same problems that we have. They had bitter waters to drink at times. And on other occasions, they were delivered from their enemies in miraculous manner. But because of unbelief, they wandered in a stagnant wilderness for 40 solid years. Until all who were over 40 when they left the land of Canaan, or over 20, were all dead, and a new generation had arisen to take their place. It took them that long to reach the promised land. But after all of their problems were over, and after all of their quarreling was done, and after the internal divisions of Israel had been settled mostly by the hand of death, there was a young fellow named Joshua who led the children of Israel across the divided Jordan into the land that flowed with milk and honey. Even though he was about 80 when he did it, he was still a young fellow, able to lead the armies of Israel until they cut the land in two. For they went almost straight from Jericho to the Mediterranean Sea. And then they turned southward, and they took Jerusalem, and they took Bethlehem, and they took Hebron, and they took a dozen other little city-states, and destroyed their armies, possessed their lands. They lived in houses they hadn't built. They drank water out of wells they hadn't dug. They ate grapes off of vineyards that they hadn't planted. And then they came back to their beginning place and took a northern route and made a campaign up through the valley of Jezreel, conquering every city-state in their path until the whole land had been given to them by their God. It wasn't by their might, nor their skill, nor their numbers that victory came to them. It was because they fought under the banner of Jehovah, and it was the banner of Jehovah that conquered the land. And the enemies soon learned that it was useless to fight against Israel because they said Israel's God fights with them. And they understood full well that God on any man's side makes that side the most powerful. But everything kind of settled down and the wars were over and the contention between brethren had eased up. And Joshua sat down about halfway between Bethel and Jericho at a little place called Gilgal. And he started parceling out the land. 2.5 tribes had gotten the land east of the Jordan. And after having won the land of Canaan, they were ready to return to their respective allotments. And the other tribes were being given their parcels of land, some in the north and some in the middle part of the country and some in the southern part of the country. And there came a strange fellow to Joshua. He wasn't the same age as the rest of them at all. He was as old as Joshua. He came on his birthday. He was 85 years old. And this record, which you'll find if you want to read it, in the 14th and part of the 15th chapters of the book of Joshua, gives me one of the most thrilling insights into Israel's history that I've ever had. This fellow's name was Caleb. He and Joshua were the only two above the age limit that came out of Canaan, that came out of Egypt, that entered into Canaan. And you know why all the rest of them died and these two men lived? The rest of them thought it couldn't be done. These two men thought it could, and 40 years after they thought it could, they did it. And this was one of the two men. His name was Caleb. He was the same age as Jimmy Lovell. At most time when folks are asking for a rocking chair, this fella asked for a mountain. He said, Joshua, you remember 45 years ago when we went over into the land of Canaan? I scouted out the country around Hebron. I saw that the mountain of Hebron had some great cities on it. The cities had high walls around them, and the cities were filled with giants. There was a wilderness surrounding the place. It was really a tough-looking place. But I thought that by the power of God we could take it, and I went back home and said so. The other spies didn't think so, and the children of Israel believed them and didn't believe you and me. And at that time, God promised me that one of these days He'd give me that mountain. And Moses also promised me that when the time finally came, I would be given the mountain of Hebron. And he said, Joshua, you'll remember that you also promised me. And now I've come to claim my inheritance. Give me that mountain. Now, here was a fella at the age when most members of the church think they're too old to do anything, where they decide they are ready to be laid on the shelf, are ready to sit in the rocking chair. And they're saying, I've taught this Bible class long enough, get somebody else to take it for a while. Some of them are saying, I've served as an elder in this congregation my allotted time. Pick somebody else and let me retire. Preachers sometimes do that. And I like to go back to the middle of Joshua and read it again anytime the idea hits my mind that maybe I am over the hill. I have not yet reached the place where I don't want another mountain to conquer. I hate to see any person in the kingdom of God who's decided he's climbed his last hill, scaled his last mountain, conquered his last fortress, and now it's time for him to rest on spiritual Social Security. You may retire from some of the jobs that mortals have, but there's no way under heaven for a person to retire from the task laid upon him when he was baptized into Jesus. You never reach the place where you can retire. And here was a fellow, 85 years old. He said, I'm as strong as I ever was. I'm as good a warrior as I ever was. I know it's going to be a job to subdue that mountain and conquer those cities and destroy those enemies. But I think I can. Give me this mountain. I just glory in old Caleb's faith and his spunk. No shade of a palm tree for him. No place to sit down and rest for Caleb. No place to admire the gathering evening shadows nor the glory of a red sunset. He was still looking for the front on the battlefield. He was looking for a job that would humble a lot younger men than he. Now, I noticed this, that scattered around our brotherhood, after we've come through all the wildernesses of the last 150 years and have got recognizable congregations planted on the right side of the tracks in nearly every town in the country, there is a great tendency for us to sit down and enjoy the spoils of our victories. We've built ourselves a fine church house. We've made it into a windowless mausoleum filled with padded pews and air conditioning. And we are satisfied to gather our own flock with ourselves to worship regularly in ritualistic form while a whole world goes to hell all around us and we don't really care. I know we don't really care. or we'd be doing more about it than we are. Just here and there you will see some hardy soul, much older than most of his fellows, who still wants a mountain to conquer. I was talking to a fellow from Arizona in the exhibit hall over there a few minutes ago, who showed me the back pages off of 262 World Bible Correspondence Course lessons signed by people who wanted to be baptized into Christ. And he said, "These are the ones I have received back wanting to be baptized since I began teaching the Bible by correspondence." Let me ask you, how long has it been since you baptized 262? And he was almost to the place where folks are hunting a rocking chair. You take Jimmy Lovell with his idea of giving everybody in America, much less the world, everybody in America a chance to study the Bible by mail. Here at 85, where most people long ago have decided that they are ready to retire, and most of the church has decided that we'll just have to put up with the old fogey until finally time takes him. But at 85, Jimmy's brain is just as fertile as it ever was. And from the great ideas of World Bible School among foreign lands, he turns to an effort to get it before all people in the United States. And those plans are well along the road to maturity. I noticed a report the other day made by Jules Miller, who said that he had canvassed 1,400 churches who had returned his questionnaire, and that's good for us out of 10,000, you know, for 1,400 of them to reply. And they had said, in the last year, we have baptized 32,000 people. 1,400 churches baptized 32,000 people. And then they said to Jimmy, "How many have you baptized?" And the report came back, 46,000 in a single year. 1,400 of our best churches baptized 32,000. World Bible School baptizes 46,000. I know what you're ready to say. That, oh, they just were baptized. They'll never know what happened to them. But those whom we have been able to check on, which is the most of them, we find the average to be fully as good as it is among those baptized here in Tulsa or in Oklahoma City. They're starting congregations of their own. That work is spreading because an 85-year-old man said, "Give me this mountain. Don't give me a rocking chair. Give me this mountain." And now he's turning to 180 million people in an effort to get the gospel to them. You know, some of the finest work that's being done is being done by people of Caleb's age today. So don't get the idea that folks just lived longer back then than they do now, and that they had supernatural abilities back then that they don't have now. That isn't true. There are still plenty of mountains. And God is waiting for somebody, instead of saying, "Don't call on me, I can't," to say, "Give me this mountain. I'm as strong as I ever was. I have the use of my faculties. I can and I will do this thing for the Lord." In this same connection, we have in our congregation, Westover Hills, or did have in Austin, a woman in her early 90s. Her name was Winnie Weldon. She had taught Bible classes all her life, until finally they had to put her in a nursing home because of a broken limb. And there she sat in her wheelchair, and we'd go to see her, and she would fret at the fact that she couldn't be out at work for the Lord, and she was in her 90s. And finally she said one day to me, "Couldn't you make me a board to lay over the arms of my wheelchair and bring me some correspondence courses? I want to teach just one more soul the truth before I die." And I made the board and brought the courses. And all the other old folks in that nurse's home said, "Winnie, what are you doing?" And when she told them, they wanted to do it too. And so they developed what we call our wheelchair brigade. There are 16 or 17 of them, and they roll their wheelchairs up arm to arm in the sun porch every afternoon, and they grade Bible correspondence courses, and they're teaching people in a dozen nations. And when he finally went in and got a sheet off of the bed and came in and thumbtacked it on the wall, and they draw lines on it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and that's not domino scores. They have the sheet about a third full of marks now of people from their wheelchairs. They have taught the truth and have seen baptized, and they have their names and addresses. Here was a 90-year-old woman wanting a mountain when most folks are wanting a rocking chair. I'll tell you, you don't ever get to the place where you can't be worth something to the kingdom of God unless you yourself decide you've got to that place. Most of you here have already reared your families. Younger family members are at home keeping children in school and making a living in the sweatshop. But you have kind of freed yourself to where you could come to a meeting like this. And I am thankful that you're here. And I'm thankful for the chance to talk to you. You came probably to enjoy the sweet fellowship of this group of people, and that's fine. But if we just develop a seminar syndrome where people go to meetings and hear speeches and go home and tell how good they were, and that's all it amounts to, then we're wasting our time. But if some way I can inspire you to ask the Lord for another mountain before you die, then this week will not have been spent in vain. We had another member of our congregation who a couple of weeks ago attended a seminar like this one. He had been president of an insurance company. He had been an elder in four or five congregations. He had suffered three or four heart attacks. He was at the place where everybody felt like he was ready to sit down and enjoy the last few years of old age. And he had bought him a condominium in the middle of a golf range. He was pretty well set up until he attended that seminar. When he came back home, it took him 10 days to touch the ground. And he said, "My wife and I are going to lock up our house, and we're going to Barbados on a 3-month campaign, and when it's over with, we may just stay a year and help them down there." Somebody had showed him a mountain. And right when he was expecting to settle down, here was an opportunity that he couldn't turn down. And here was the kind of faith that was saying, "Lord, give me this mountain." Now the Lord only knows how many opportunities there are out there that you could take advantage of. The wilderness is full of mountains, and the mountains are full of giants, and there are great cities with high walls that must be knocked down or climbed over, and it'll stay a wilderness of heathen souls lost and doomed for hell. Unless somebody says, give me that mountain, I'll take care of it. And that's what I'm pleading with you for here today. There's a lesson in the book of Joshua. Lord, give me this mountain. There would have been every good excuse in the world for Caleb not to have done it. He probably didn't want to get that far away from his children and grandchildren. He probably figured out that he had done his allotment of traveling and fighting and conquering. And he probably was saying, you ought to go down and conquer that city and build me an old folks' home on one corner of it and reserve the first room for me. But he didn't leave somebody to do that. He said, give me that mountain. I'll take care of it. And he thought he could. He didn't have one doubt in the world but what he could do it. You know, to make that lesson, to bring it right down close to home to us, we live in an age in which the line is clearly drawn between a hedonistic, godless, materialistic world and in the spiritual, everlasting kingdom of God. The gray area occupied by denominational religion and Roman Catholicism and, quote, Christianity has just about disappeared. And most of it has faded back into the world. And a big part of people who still have some tangible connection to a church only use that relationship to get married decently or buried right. That's about all it amounts to. And there is just one island left in the spiritual realm that it really has any chance of cutting any ice in our world as it continues to get darker and darker. And that's the church. I talked to a Catholic priest one time who said to me, Roman Catholicism no longer fears denominational Christianity. He said, before the end of time, the world will either all become Roman Catholic or all Church of Christ, one of the two. He said, you are the only people who even pretend any longer to believe the Bible or go by the Bible. And he said, it's getting down to where it's us or you. I do not share the idea that the church will go either direction or that the world will go either direction. I don't believe with Camel that the church will be converted before the end of time and usher in a millennium. And I don't believe with Roman Catholicism that the church will be totally conquered by a pseudo-military religious state storms until in the twinkling of an eye, God shall say that's enough. And conditions will be pretty much what they are right now. But I was interested in what the priest said. For he was actually saying that you are the only people left in the world who even claim to be identical with what the New Testament teaches people should be. And I think that's right. And we are not cutting the swath in our society that we ought to cut. We've reached the point where there is so much of the world in the church and so much of the church in the world that you can't tell where the world ends and the church begins. And the moral cankers of our modern society have so affected the church that even the leadership of the church sometime is festering from it. The educational apparatus of the land is already pretty well controlled by godless atheism. And there has been for the last 25 years a concerted effort to fill the textbooks your children study with a conglomeration of senseless foolishness regarding origins and regarding social and economical rules of righteousness. We live in an age in which every man is his own law, in which you're all right, I'm all right, you're okay, I'm okay, in which evil is only in the eye of the beholder, where the person himself existentially sets the norm, and society in general has totally dethroned God and enthroned the human intellect and human emotions. And people are trusting what they feel instead of what they read out of the scriptures. I'll tell you, our old social mountain is infested with giants. It has become a wilderness. And the walls that defend this godless atheism grow higher and higher every year. We need some men of courage and of faith who are willing to say, "Give me this mountain, I'll tackle it." And we need mothers and fathers who will take an interest in what's going on in the educational circles of our land and even in the political circles of our land. We need Christians willing to stand for decency and morality, because we've got a hard fight with a short stick. And if it was just this little handful of human beings doing the fighting, we are already doomed to failure. And most of our shrinkage today, I'm willing to lay upon the basis of our thinking that we got to do this job all by ourselves. I want you to know the God of Israel fights with you. The God who conquered an army with lights inside of pitchers. The God who made axe heads float. The God who slew the enemy with the dry jawbone of an ass. The God who killed a giant whose spear was as big as a weaver's beam with a little round rock. That God is your God. That power is your power. And we can turn this society around. We can re-civilize our civilization. But we're going to have to trust in God like Caleb did if we do it. We'll never do it by our own power or by our own might. So I'm pleading with you for the kind of faith that dares to tackle the impossible. When you came into Jesus Christ, you walked out of a kingdom limited by time and space and matter into a kingdom that knows no time, no space, no matter, where souls never grow, but where they have already laid hold on eternal life. And all the ordinary limitations that make men little have disappeared until the littlest of men can be big. Lord, give me this mountain.